I'll call our third case this morning. Our third case is case number A24-0328 in the matter of SW. Good morning to both counsel. I assume, counsel for respondent, that you're the only attorney presenting argument today.
Yes, Your Honor.
Despite my lengthy list of attorneys. excellent. As I am sure you both know, you'll each be given 15 minutes for your argument, and appellants, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Before beginning your argument, please feel free to take time to adjust the podium to a height that's comfortable for you, and then if you could please identify yourself and your client for the record before beginning your argument, it would be much appreciated.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Brooke Beskow-Ward, and I represent appellant mother SW in this appeal of the order involuntarily transferring custody of her child to the child's non-relative foster parents. Mother asks this court to reverse the transfer of custody order and remand to the district court for further proceedings. Mother raises three issues in her brief. I'd like to focus my attention here first on the first issue raised, which is whether the district court erred when it determined the department provided active efforts to rehabilitate mother and reunify the family.
Before you proceed, I just want to clarify your argument sort of in a broad perspective. You agree that the district court made all of the statutory findings under 260C.517. Correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're not arguing that any of the sort of the underlying fact findings are clearly erroneous? I think your focus is on the sort of decisional findings about best interests and active efforts.
That's correct.
And then within best interest, I think I understand your argument to be that because the department did not make the requisite active efforts, that transfer of legal custody for that reason is not in the child's best interest.
That is correct,
okay.
Your Honor.
Thank you.
Under ICWA and MIFPA, which apply to this matter because of the child's eligibility for enrollment, we cannot make a best interest determination when the department has failed to comply with the mandates in ICWA and MIFPA. In this case, because the department did not comply with the active efforts component, which is an essential and incredibly important aspect of these cases, it cannot be said that it was in the best interest of the child to transfer custody. That being said, turning a little bit to the transfer, to the active efforts issue, in these cases, which are governed by ICWA and MIFPA, the failure of the department to provide active efforts precludes a transfer of custody or any other permanency decision in these cases. In this case, the department did not even satisfy the reasonable efforts standard, which is a lower standard by statute, satisfy that reasonable efforts standard. And I'm basing that on the Supreme Court case in Re Children of TR. In that case, we had a non-custodial father.
I'm familiar with TR. I wrote for the Court of Appeals and was reversed by the Supreme Court on that particular case. But in TR, the father failed to comply by not reporting for his testing. And it looks here that there's a big difference between TR and the case at hand because the assessments were made. She didn't comply with an assessment. She was recommended she go to outpatient. It seems to me that they were more hands-on with your client than they ever were with the dad in TR, at least according to the Supreme Court's review of the case. But I distinguish it in that sense. Here's my question. I am getting to a question. What is lacking? What did the county not do? Point me to one or two things that you think are red flags that the county failed to do.
Sure. In this case, I think the failure was the failure to make a referral or do anything to get mother into treatment once there was a recommendation from a chemical dependency assessment that she needed to attend outpatient treatment.
And that was at the brink of trial? It was about to go to trial?
It was, Your Honor, yes. The record's somewhat unclear as to when exactly the chemical dependency evaluation occurred. It's somewhere between September and October. But regardless, the results came back at least before trial, is my understanding based on the record. And at that point, the caseworker testified that the assessment said mother needed to attend outpatient treatment. This was in conjunction with her testimony that there were great concerns about returning this child to mother's care because of the unsustained sobriety, the, you know, back and forth on the testing. Some were positive, some were not, some were missed, which were all presumed positive. And that she
did have the in-home peer counseling. That intensity of somebody being there for her.
She did have that, yes. I would argue that does not qualify as treatment, and the caseworker even said, mother needs to attend treatment. This has been a recommendation. She needs to attend treatment. She has not done that, so I have concerns about returning this child to her care.
My concern here is how do you fault the department for the failure to provide treatment when it was mother's own conduct during the first two chemical evaluations saying, no, I'm not using, that was the reason why treatment wasn't offered to her in the first place? How can you fault the department for that?
So first of all, there were, as Your Honor noted, there were three chemical dependency evaluations. The first one occurred in winter of 2020. And in that one, there is evidence in the record that whoever was doing the assessment, reached out to the department at least on two occasions, left voicemails asking for collateral, and the department never reached out. Why that happened, the record isn't clear, doesn't give an answer, but that was certainly not mother's fault. There was an attempt
there to collect. Well, but mother misrepresented, right? I mean, she was continuing to use. I mean, I think she continues to say to this day that she hasn't used since 2016, but our record shows otherwise, right, between the positive UAs and the 100 missed UAs.
Yep, and that right there triggers the county's obligation to make a referral for treatment, especially when there is a chemical dependency evaluation that recommends that treatment, and that came while the case was ongoing. We did not have a decision at that point. Yes, it was on the brink of trial, but that is of no consequence here because the department is required to make active efforts throughout the case all the way until we have a decision. And so it really does not matter when the timing of that was. Had the department made...
Although at that point the child had been out of custody, out of mom's care for almost three... I mean, well beyond the statutory time periods, right? I mean, three years at that point.
Yep, it was a lengthy case, absolutely. And throughout the duration of the case, the department had concerns about mother's ongoing use, and yet there was never a referral for treatment. There was not that collateral provided for the first.
Can the county make a referral for treatment if they don't have an assessment that says she needs treatment?
I don't know that they are able to do that, but then in that case, if they had issues
with... So this comes back, I think, to Judge Bjorkman's question, which is if your client is doing these assessments and isn't being honest about her need to be going to treatment, mm-hmm. and the county is continuing to offer these assessments to try to get it so that she would qualify for those services, I mean, it does... seem somewhat that it might be tactical to wait until the eve of trial before you're being honest in your assessment to try to continue to push proceedings out, right? I mean, I think that, I guess my question is, if we adopted your argument, are we creating the opportunity for people to extend these proceedings out when we are obligated by statute to be trying to move these forward in a manner that's in the best interest of the children?
I don't believe that would be the case. As I said, the first assessment, the county did not provide collateral for. Had they wanted an assessment that was reliable by their standard, they needed to order an assessment that required that collateral. In the last one, and to address Your Honor's point about well, the parent could just be honest at the end. I don't know that the record says that mother was necessarily super honest in the last one. What made the difference was the collateral from the department. They needed to provide that. And so they need to ensure that there is an assessment.
So what happened in the second assessment then?
It's unclear in the record why collateral was not provided for that one. I don't know if there is any evidence in the record showing that the department just failed to do that, that the information to contact the department was not provided. I don't know whose fault it was there. I don't think the record is clear on that or there is any evidence showing either way. But it is clear in the record that in the first one, at least, the one very early on in the case, that the department did not provide any collateral for that, even though they were reached or they were contacted to do so, at least I believe on two occasions is what the record shows. And I don't believe there's any dispute about that from respondent. I also believe there's also no dispute that the department did not offer any sort of referral or assist mother in finding any sort of treatment option once that was recommended by that chemical health assessment.
Did mother file any kind of motion asking to push out the trial date so that she could attend treatment?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
And are there any, you know, sort of procedural obligations on the parent in a case like this to be taking those steps if they think treatment is going to be beneficial to their case?
To submit a motion? Is that what Your Honor is?
It seems like, you know, one potential remedy mother might have had in this case is to file a motion to push out the trial date so that she could attend treatment, which then she could have used that evidence at, you know, the subsequent hearing. Did mother have that kind of obligation in order for us to say the county really, really failed in this case when it's not clear she could have even completed treatment before the trial?
So I'm not aware of any sort of rule or statutory obligation that says mother has to ask for a continuance. Could she have asked for a continuance? Sure. That is a discretionary decision with the district court in this case. My guess is it probably would not have been granted given that the timelines were an issue and we had gone much past those timelines and the court expressed concerns about that in its order. Part of the decision was that we needed to come to a permanency decision because this child had been out of home for 3 years. And so I don't know that mother had any sort of obligation, but what is clear in statute is that the department had an obligation to provide active efforts before any sort of permanency outcome was reached. That did not happen here.
Isn't the other side of that coin that even if mother had attended treatment at this point, it probably wasn't going to change the outcome of the hearing, right? I mean, like, isn't the flip side of what you're saying, which is, well, they probably wouldn't have granted the continuance because of how long this had gone on, isn't the flip side of that coin that if she wasn't able to complete treatment before this hearing occurred, that it might not have really changed the outcome of this case?
If we're focusing on the active efforts requirement, regardless of what the outcome was going to be for mother and treatment, whether she was actually going to attend treatment if they made a referral, whether she was going to complete that treatment, it doesn't matter. The county had an obligation to provide active efforts, and they didn't.
So you're saying that the violation here is simply the failure to make the referral by itself shows that active efforts did not occur in this case?
I believe, yes. The fact that the county did not provide her or offer her services to attend treatment once that was recommended was a failure of active efforts in this case that precludes a transfer of custody. It also, because
even if attending the treatment wouldn't have changed the outcome of the...
Well, I don't know that we can say for certain right now what would have happened. My point is that at the point where there was a recommendation for treatment, the county, to satisfy their obligation to provide active efforts, needed to make that referral. They needed to at least attempt to assist mother to get into treatment in order to satisfy their statutory obligation.
Let me ask you this. Mother apparently agreed in April of 2023, 6 months before the trial, that the department had made appropriate active efforts to reunify her with her older child, her daughter. Isn't that strong evidence that the department also did so with respect to this child?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. It is true that the court
made... Does your argument, your answer, simply turn on the failure to provide inpatient treatment in October of 2023?
Yes, which happened after the court made that initial finding with regards to the other child.
And doesn't case law suggest that failure to provide one particular service isn't necessarily a failure of reasonable efforts and, by extrapolation, active efforts?
Well, I would again point to TR, which in that case really did hinge on the fact that the department did not provide any resources to the father to attend treatment, despite the fact that he had positive tests, despite the fact that he had chemical dependency evaluations.
What was that, the decisional point? I read TR to be more concerned with the fact that there had been no findings that that father's chemical use affected his ability to parent the child. It's a palpable and unfitness case. Am I wrong about that?
That was under the statutory ground analysis. They also did address the reasonable efforts piece of it, and that came down to an issue of whether the department did actually provide reasonable efforts to this father. In that case, their primary concern was that father was not offered any sort of chemical dependency treatment, despite the fact that there was ongoing chemical use or that there were indications of use and that he needed treatment. And so I would say that this case is...
Was there an assessment in TR? I'm just trying to remember.
There were three assessments in TR.
There were three assessments in TR.
Mm-hmm. There were assessments in that case. Again, the record in that case showed that he needed treatment, and the department did not provide it. That, the court found, was a failure of reasonable efforts. Under the active efforts standard, we just can't get there with this case. So we'd ask this court to reverse and remand for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent. It's in the middle.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Mary Lynch with the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, representing Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health Department, the Children and Family Services Units. The department does contend that active efforts were provided. I think there's a variety of ways that that can be looked at and analyzed. First of all, although the department does not agree that active efforts were not provided at the very end of the case, even if that one element
had... It's a timetable between the recommendation that her desire and recommendation she entered chemical dependency treatment and then the trial.
So my understanding was that we did not actually have, or they did not actually have at the time of trial, the written recommendation. The child protection social worker testified that the child protection social worker had received verbally information that outpatient treatment had been recommended. I don't remember any evidence or testimony that SW was asking for it, but that there was the statement of the child protection social worker that outpatient treatment had been recommended. The social worker, I believe, also testified that the social worker had not received the actual recommendation, the report that would have enabled the referral. The issue of whether or not just the single a referral for outpatient treatment, the issue of whether or not that element had happened was not litigated.
Do you need the report before you make a referral? In a normal case, do you wait to get the report before making a referral?
So the agency doesn't actually make that, doesn't make the chemical health treatment referral. That comes out of the referral, the substance use disorder evaluation, formerly called a Rule 25 and a chemical health assessment. That comes out of that process. That recommendation actually, that process actually identifies a specific program, and then that's the place where the client has the opportunity to enter.
But temporally, does the report usually come out first? Like, what's the normal process for how that happens and when you would get it? So normally you'd have the determination, then there would be the report, and then there would be the referral?
Yes.
Okay.
And there is sometimes, discussion about sometimes the report will, again, none of this was litigated in this case, but there would be the report would identify a specific program for treatment. My memory is that outpatient treatment is what the social worker testified was recommended, and that there is sometimes discussion then about whether or not that is the program the person can and will enter.
But in any event,
here.
Mom, in this case, she didn't ask that the proceedings be extended or postponed so that she could seek that out?
She did not. It was, she did, she testified, her, she had the opportunity to present that through counsel. The procedural element didn't happen. There was not in her testimony, at least at my read, that she was, you know, ready and waiting to go to outpatient treatment. She, in fact, continued to deny that she was using chemicals. She testified that she thought that the various positive results during the 3 years that the case was open had been false positives. So she was, to the extent that it matters, she was not to that point.
Well, with that said, a lot of the determination as to whether she was accepting of the fact she needed chemical dependency treatment rested a lot with the court questioning. Can you explain, and I know that wasn't a part of the, it's in the briefing, but it was not a part of the argument of appellant counsel, but in this case, is that typical for a trial judge in this instance to ferret out the information as to whether she believed or not that these tests were positive or false?
It is not extremely unusual for the trial judges to, for the bench to ask questions in child protection cases. I think that the specific focus on what appellant thought about the test results, you know, was notable. I mean, that clearly mattered to the trial court.
Would this not normally be the function of yourself at trial versus the court having to make those inquiries? I'm concerned about that because it seems it went to the heart of many of the matters that should have been brought out by the county.
There was extensive documented evidence that talked about the different UAs. The social worker had tested about the different testing. It wasn't just UAs. And the social worker provided context to that. The social worker also talked about the numbers of missed UAs, the numbers of missed and problematic test results, the conversations that the social worker had with appellant herself and with others about the importance to document sobriety and or address the chemical health issue overall. What I talked about in the brief, our brief, was that the court was asking clarifying questions, was not independently creating that evidence, but was asking clarifying questions. Unclear at that point how much of the documentary evidence the court had read with that finder of fact hat on. And so I think looking at the totality of the evidence, I think it is not, again, creating evidence there with the court's questions.
Can I ask you this? What role did the department play, if any, in assisting Mother to set up the three Rule 25 evaluations that she participated in?
That was not litigated explicitly here. I believe that the social worker testified that the very first assessment was done as part of the case plan, so it's unclear, you know, what exactly that dynamic was, but that was a case plan expectation, so that's something that the agency had worked with the parent and talked about.
And what do we make of the department's failure to respond when contacted by the evaluator for collateral information?
So the social worker did not agree that she'd received a voicemail. She did. The social worker testified, I believe, at trial. I don't have the literal testimony in mind, so I apologize if I'm getting it wrong. But I believe the social worker testified at trial that she was not aware that there had been voicemails left. That she did see that in the document, but that she was not aware that voicemails had been left. The fact that there was additional engagement with appellant after that first assessment, attempts to help her establish sobriety, because appellant was continuing to say that she was sober, so the department continued to support her to establish sobriety. Offer, you know, other kinds of chemical health engagement throughout the course of the case between that late 2020 evaluation and then 2023 when she did the next one, when appellant did the next evaluation. That was in the beginning of 2023. It is, again, part of the ongoing case plan efforts. The agency attempted to work with appellant to help her understand how important that overall project was. And there is testimony about that.
You acknowledge that the department, the agency, was required to continue to make active efforts throughout the time of trial, correct?
Yes, absolutely. I think there is no sort of end to active efforts. There's no futility to active efforts.
So then how do you respond to the appellant's argument that by failing to pick up the ball and provide chemical dependency treatment when it was finally recommended by the evaluator isn't a failure of active efforts?
Well, that process wasn't done. The social worker testified to not having the report to move on to the next part of the process.
What does the agency do in terms of recognizing, in ICWA cases, the active effort role versus reasonable efforts? I mean, is there just a heightened check-the-box list in terms of what needs to be done, or how is that determined?
Well, I think that, you know, there's a definition of active efforts in the statute, in the Minnesota Indian Family Preservation Act, as well as elsewhere, that the agency needs to continue to actively engage with that parent throughout, offer a variety of different modes, a variety of different attempts. For example, a difference in this case,
So would that have been, just as an example, was that where this peer, the home peer counselor came into play?
Not just, I mean, the in-home programming is offered in Hennepin County in both types of cases, in active efforts and reasonable efforts cases. But yes, because it's an additional alternative mode. So there was a, an assessment done that did recommend documenting sobriety. That was the first one, which appellant did not do, so she was not complying with that. So there were multiple assessments. There were multiple attempts to help appellant document sobriety because she continued to say she was sober. She was offered UA. She was offered the in-home, one component of which is testing. It's not just for testing. It's also support in sobriety and support in addressing chemical health issues. The department offered different testing, there was testing within the in-home, offered patch testing, continued to discuss the issue, continued to be ready for appellant. The fact that the evaluation was facilitated, you know, basically while the trial was going on, that last evaluation, that is all part of active efforts. So it's that, you know, that's that in-depth, ongoing, you know, not stopping, basically. Things that happened in this case that, hit active efforts are, there was supervised visitation, there was parenting, that happened in the...
But those are also things that are reasonable efforts, so, yeah, I mean, I guess you have a threshold, and based on the number of cases we've heard, it seems as if what happened here is the same as the reasonable efforts case. And
well,
maybe Hennepin County just... does more.
Well, I think a lot, I mean, I think that did keep happening. I think that's one significant difference between active efforts and reasonable efforts. This case was also open for 3 years, which is, you know, perhaps, this wasn't litigated, so it's hard to say this for sure, but perhaps a function of active efforts. Again, that trying repeatedly, trying different ways, continuing to try different elements. You know, little things like all the transportation was provided. Things happened in appellant's home. Each one of those things alone isn't necessarily active efforts, but the accumulated expenditure of services is what hits the active efforts. I would also note just that, active efforts is active efforts overall. There was supportive parenting services. There was supervised visitation. There was attempts at unsupervised visitation, then back to supervised visitation.
There was criticism of mother in this case because of her relationship with the male that was involved. What was done as far as active efforts to help her through that process, if anything?
Sort of took two tracks. One was the male is the father, I believe, through recognition of parentage of the child in
right.
this case.
I guess what I'm getting at is back to, again, the judge's comments about how his name stayed on the mailbox, and he made that as a credibility determination that she was not being credible when she said it was only there for a while. So what services would have been there to help her? I mean, taking a name off of a mailbox, that's going out and scrubbing it or stripping it or something like that. So what else was done as far as helping her through that process of trying to unwind with someone?
Well, I think most part of it was the agency offered a case plan and attempted to engage with that man, and he did work on that case plan for a while. He did also continue to have ongoing chemical use issues that were partially documented by the department. He had an initial criminal charge that he picked up, and appellant herself testified at trial that she thought he was continuing to use. The primary thing was the social worker testified to discussing with appellant that the home needed to be safe, that he was an element of not being safe. Again, kind of not dissimilar to the sort of continuing to deny that she was using chemicals, appellant's answer would be, I'm not with him anymore. So with that, there isn't that much to help disengage. The agency did continue to be at, have different ways to have eyes on to be at the home. It wasn't just the name on the mailbox, but to determine, whether or not that home was safe. It's not as much sort of the just mere element, again, the one thing about the man, whether or not he was there, but whether or not the home overall was safe. And there is testimony from the social worker that throughout the life of the case, the social worker was working with appellant to help make sure that her home was safe, and that one of those elements was having him not be there. And then when there was evidence that would show up at least two different times in the social worker's testimony, firsthand, the social worker herself, seeing evidence of him being there, appellant would just say he wasn't there. So it's, there needs to be some engagement from appellant. It's the activity. That does not take away the agency's obligation to provide active efforts, but there does need to be some awareness and some engagement from appellant, and that was not here. Appellant, in addition, I would say I do agree that, active efforts need to be provided. The court needs to make findings regarding active reasonable efforts, and then also active efforts is part of best interests. Best interest, it is not the only element in best interest. We would contend that active efforts was provided here, so as a separate element of analysis and as part of best interest. And again, you must look overall the quality of the nature of the agency's engagement with the issues that are presented, and looking at that, it is clear that active efforts were provided. I am running out of time. If the court has any other questions.
I see no other questions.
Thank you. We would ask the court to affirm the transfer of permanent legal and physical custody so that this child can stay in the home the child has known, and continue to have those relationships with relatives, including appellant, that a transfer of custody provides. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Just to address a few factual points first, I would note that the department caseworker did testify on the first day of trial at page 105 that the assessment, the most recent assessment, was sent to her. However, it was sent to her in confidential mode and she did not print it. So the department did have that. They had the recommendations in hand and those were available to them. They offered to the court that they could get them for the court. It does not seem that those were ever offered into evidence, however. I would also note that page 204 of the transcript, the caseworker didn't recall that there were voicemails left to obtain that collateral, but she said that if that's what the note said, then that's what happened. I'd then point to Exhibit 15, which is the actual assessment, and that assessment does note that there were two attempts to provide to obtain collateral from CPS, and the dates were noted there. It says in both instances LVM, which I'm assuming left voice message or voicemail is what that means. I would also want to note that in terms of the argument being focused on just this one element of not providing a referral for chemical dependency treatment that was recommended. We do have the TR case, which again focused on that. I would also point to a non-precedential opinion of this court, which was relatively recent. It's in the matter of the welfare of the child of MAC. I don't have the Westlaw site, but that is A23-1149. And in that case, that was a reasonable efforts case coming out of a termination of parental rights, where this court determined that it was a failure of reasonable efforts, that the department did not provide a referral for a chemical dependency assessment for a parent where throughout the proceedings, mother failed to provide testing, but the department had suspicions the entire time that she was using. So that one did, the analysis did hinge.
I thought that what happened in Mac was that there was no assessment.
That's correct, Your Honor.
There was no, that despite strong belief that the person was using, they never actually ordered any assessment as opposed to providing treatment.
That is correct. So that hinged just on the assessment. Here, there were the assessments, but there was no opportunity for treatment despite the recommendation. So just pointing out here that it did hinge just on that one element, despite the fact that there were other efforts made throughout the case to try, in that case, to get mother to test, visitation services, parenting education, things of that nature, as there were here. But the failure of the department to provide that assessment was a failure of reasonable efforts. And again, if we're talking active efforts, that's a higher standard. If we didn't meet it in a reasonable efforts case, we certainly can't meet it in
an active efforts case. Would have been to have alerted the court to the fact that there was some type of an assessment recommendation that was coming or it was in the works, at least to step back to consider that? Is that what you're asking for as far as an active effort?
In this case, I would say that an active effort, that even the fact that we are in the middle of trial now, if the department had offered evidence that said, we got this recommendation, and on X date, a couple days later, we made a referral and we offered mother this chemical dependency treatment service, and she said, nope, I'm not doing it, we probably would have had active efforts.
Thank you.
But in this case, that did not happen. The department, there's no evidence that the department made any attempt to provide treatment services, offer those to mother, discuss those with mother, despite the fact that there was trial.
Did the parties litigate this? Did mother's lawyer raise this issue with the district court?
Mother's lawyer did not specifically raise that issue in the district court. No, there was a post-trial motion.
Was it brought to the court's attention, though, that this was out there percolating?
That the chemical dependency evaluation occurred?
Yes,
it was evidence in testimony. The caseworker testified that she did receive this chemical dependency assessment from September, October, that she had the results, that it recommended outpatient treatment. And she went so far as to say that we can't reunify, we can't have this child in mother's care because she has not followed through on the recommendations of that assessment.
Okay, so mother didn't ask that anything be halted, but on the other hand, the county didn't say, look, we could do this for you. They didn't offer it to her. Is that a fair statement of how it played out?
I would say that is a fair statement of how it played out. Yes, Your Honor. And I see my time is up here, so again, I would ask this court to reverse and remand to the district court for further proceedings to provide mother active efforts in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel in this case. This case has been submitted, and we will issue an opinion in this matter in the time prescribed by statute.